So maybe a first question would be, give us a state of just your tribe. Madison has just been designated in December, Truax Field, as the home of F35A. Doctor, can you start? Give us an overview. Wisconsin Eye is in La Crosse. We are interviewing one of the most successful business executives in Wisconsin. Don Weber was raised on a Cashton area dairy farm, went off to the Marines as a rifleman in Vietnam at age 18, came back and felt the dislocation of a returning vet. But he had a knack for starting and growing businesses, including Logistics Health, were in its corporate office. He and his family have also invested in downtown La Crosse in a way that has remade the downtown. Mr. Weber, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for being here.
You have a fascinating narrative. I want to pick it up when you went to Vietnam at 18, 393 days in country. You come back. I use the word dislocation. Is that the wrong term? Were you a little bit more troubled than that, sir?
Well, first of all, was very blessed to come back. I realized shortly after I landed in Vietnam, and I was up on a DMZ, I was not in control. Someone much greater than myself was really in control, and really figured out how precious life was, and each day, to get through each day, and 393 days later, I came home. I was a changed person. Anyone who is deployed into combat is never going to be the same. Wars are very ugly. They scar you for life. Often physical wounds heal, but the spirit of the war is always there. It's in your soul. So I really struggled when I came back. I had this guilt. And I always say guilt is to the soul what pain is to the body. You know, when you have pain, you do something to get over it. You need to do that with guilt. I made some bad choices trying to deal with this guilt. I've learned that you need to take ownership of your choices. And I started feeling sorry for myself. Self-pity. There's nothing worse because you end up digging a hole so deep, eventually you're not going to get out of it. And that's what I was doing. And I needed to get a job.
Were you at one point homeless, sir?
I was, yes, pretty much living on the street for a while. I had an old car I slept in off and on. Back then, YMCAs, some of them, you could rent a room for $6-7 a night. And you know, when I'd collect $6 or $7, I would get myself a room and, you know, get a good night's sleep and a shower. But that's when I realized that if I don't do something, it's up to me. You were ashamed to even tell anyone that you had served. I just had a hard time dealing with that. No one, I don't know anyone who really is encouraged by wars and combat. But young men and women who serve, who volunteer and serve, I mean, it's approximately 1% of our population.
Right.
And you think about, which we don't often, think about each morning we get up, the sacrifices that have been made. I thank God every morning I get up. for these sacrifices so I can enjoy these freedoms. That 1% volunteer, I mean, you know, they don't know what's ahead of them. And once they decide to serve, it's the first step in a long journey to honor.
And in this era, there was a draft, but you enlisted at age 18.
I didn't. Yes, my father served and was a POW. I had no idea the horrors he carried with him most of his life as a young man, working next to him on the farm, and how he struggled. Because it hadn't been that many years before, he was in a concentration camp. And my father had the will. He had the will to live, and he was a survivor when most gave up, or I wouldn't be here. And it takes a lot of courage. And, you know, he escaped. No food, no weapon. And they caught up to him 3 days later. And that was the point where they almost executed him. But he survived and came home. And so I understand now, you know, it's because of instinctively growing up next to my dad, I learned how to survive. And that will to never give up.
Did your dad give you the best advice you've ever gotten, or did he just model these values
that he modeled
that you carry to this day?
No, he modeled those values. He never really talked about it. And I had no idea until later in my life what he went through. I wish I had. We'd get done with chores at 9 o'clock at night. My father smoked. Before we'd go into the farmhouse, we would sit there on the lawn. He'd have a cigarette. And like any young 10, 11-year-old, I'd be asking him things. We'd be having discussions, and often he wouldn't even respond to me. And I would look at him, and he was just gazing at the stars, like he had never even heard what I was talking about. And I didn't understand what he was going through. I do now.
You do.
And so many who serve, who have been deployed, who come back, need help. Help in transitioning back and into a productive life. And most people, you can sit and discuss the ugliness of combat. Unless you've been there, you can't feel it. And, you know, taking another life is not natural. And when you're 18 years old and that happens and you walk up and you look into the eyes of that person, because when you die in fear, you die with your eyes open. And you begin to ask yourself, well, you know, they must have a family. There's got to be a mother somewhere, a father. You know, but if it hadn't been you, fortunately for me, you know, he'd have been looking into my eyes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, those things aren't normal. And then the innocent victims and little children. I thought we were poor farmers. But my mom always made sure we had a meal. We had a bed to sleep in. We had an old car, it was rusted out, and I was embarrassed at the time to ride to church on Sunday in it. But then, all of a sudden, I'm in a whole different part of the world.
Right.
And then I realized how blessed I was.
You come back, and you're, for a time, living in your vehicle, but there must have been a moment of personal epiphany or an anchor that was given you. Do you remember the day that you got serious about building a career, obviously a very successful career, Mr. Weber?
Well, I did. I mean, I realized one night it was storming out. And I began to think about, you know, it wasn't that long ago, it was the monsoon season. I spent most of my 393 nights, days in foxholes and trenches, wet, muddy, but I was dry. No one was shooting at me, and there was no incoming. I said to myself, the worst is behind me. I don't know what my future holds, but it's up to me to do something about it. And I got myself a job. I've laid water and sewer main. I've paid driveways. And 2 years later, I dug myself out of that hole. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea really where life was going to take me. I'm a risk taker. And I encourage people. We have a lot of young people that work here. 80% of our employees are in their 20s and 30s. They're family. And I encourage them to, we all have a comfort zone that we kind of live in. But for me, most of my life, I've lived outside of that comfort zone. And I encourage them to do that, to step outside of that comfort zone and take risk. And I mean risk in every sense of the word. And when you do, you will expand upon, you know, what you ever thought you could do or be when it comes to leadership, responsibility, selflessness, and courage. I talk about courage all the time. It takes a lot of courage, and you're going to fail at times. And so, you know, I had an idea to start a business. I had no financial means. When my father passed away, they had $7,000. Mm-hmm. But I often remind myself that they lived a rich, full life. At the end of the day, they always had peace of mind and a sense of fulfillment. It wasn't about material wealth. My mother would be making an extra meal for someone, or my father would be out helping someone, you know, with some, you know, work or need that was a challenge they had. And I would often ask myself, well, geez, you know, why aren't we doing this for ourselves? See, I was being selfish. And so I am so blessed to have been raised by a family who, you know, really understood what's most important in life, and that's that we live in have a purpose. Mm-hmm.
What was the first business that you started?
It was back in the late 78, 79. We had the oil embargo. So here I am, I'm 30 years old, 31, back on my feet, met my wife, we weren't married yet, and you know, we had plans to get married in a couple years, and so the Gulf countries who supplied us with most of our oil, mm-hmm. Placed an embargo and stopped shipping oil to the United States. And I remember waiting, you know, in line at gas stations, and they'd ration out 5 gallons of gas. And so a lot of our homes were heated with gas or, you know, oil. And so a lot of people were concerned, geez, you know, are we going to be able to heat our homes in the wintertime? And I met a fellow who was an inventor, and he had invented a heat exchanger to heat your homes that was multi-purpose. You could use oil, gas, wood, or coal. He had it patented, but he didn't know what to do with it. So I didn't have any financial means to acquire the patent, but I said, hey, if I'll take this and I think we can develop this into a successful business, and if we do, you'll be well rewarded. And so, you know, I put together, you know, an opportunity to take this patent, and I was able to raise some money, but I also got traditional financing. Banks back then were a little easier to work with than today. Uh-huh. And we started out, and you know, it was very successful in the beginning. And sometimes too fast of growth can be as damaging as no growth at all. The business really took off. And I was hiring more and more people, needed more financing. The banks would lend me more money. I had a open-ended rate. So interest rates at the time were 10.5%, and I was paying 2 points above prime. Mm. Well, 18 months later, prime hit 21.5%.
Oh.
And I couldn't even make my interest payments. So, people stopped building homes. They stopped remodeling. Everything was pretty much at a standstill. And here I sat with this company. I had $1.2 million in debt, had gotten married. My wife and I had bought our first home on a land contract, had our first child, and it all fell apart. The bank repossessed, took the business, what was left of it, and our home. But what I had been through,
yes,
and what I knew my father at that point had been through, I'm a survivor. So I went out and found an old farmhouse that hadn't been lived in. It was a hired hand's house. Hadn't been lived in for about 5-6 years. There were broken windows. It had a dirt cellar that had rodents living in it. I remember the old front porch was half rotted away. I didn't have to pay any rent. But for me, it was shelter. But I had a wife, and now she was pregnant with our second child and our daughter, and no health insurance. I really did not believe she would stay with me, and I wouldn't have blamed her, but she did. And again, I learned that I'll never put any kind of work beneath me or beneath my dignity. I will always have a job, no matter what it is. If I need to lay water and sewer main again, if I need to milk cows, if whatever. And so, I had to claw my way back. And the thing that hurt me most, I had 28 employees. I'll never forget that day when I came in and had to tell them they no longer had a job. They trusted that I was making good decisions. And I thought I was. Some of them may have lost their homes. And I'll never forget that.
You still carry it to this day?
Every Monday, I get to do new employee orientation.
You do?
Yesterday, we had 24 new employees. Last Monday, we had 15. And I think about it every time I get up and meet these new employees.
How many employees does Logistics Health have in this region, sir?
We have a total right now of almost 2,300 employees.
That's a big family.
When I talk to them, they're not employees. They are family. I'm blessed every week that new employees come on board, that they join our family. I tell them that. This day and age, they're leaving other careers. They're coming here. We had over 11,260 applications last year in 2017. We're going to have over 20,000 this year. Out of those 2,300 employees, approximately 1,800, I think, are here. Mm-hmm. In La Crosse, approximately. Mm-hmm. We opened offices in Eau Claire. So I think we have about 120 employees in Eau Claire. And we have now a couple hundred employees in Tampa. We took over an office down there. And so, I remember the day that I had a small office, a very small office. I had a desk and a telephone.
Huh. Did you start Logistics Health, or did someone else start it, and you took it over.
No, I started.
You started it.
Every one of the businesses I've started from scratch. I've never taken a business over.
What was your vision for this company that grew so successfully?
It was a way for me, first of all, I felt, as I said, this guilt that I carried, and I still at times feel it, to give back to the men and women who served, to the families who've lost loved ones. And so I always watch, you know, what's going on in the world. It's I don't look at trendy things, but we were deploying men and women into the Gulf, you know, during the Gulf War time, Kuwait and Iraq early on, that were not what they said medically ready. Many of them were coming back, or a lot of medical issues. So Congress investigated, found out that less than a third of our men and women who served, think about this, volunteered to serve, were what we considered medically ready to go to be deployed into a theater to fight in combat. And so they're all, in November of 1998, they passed a bill and said you could no longer, the Department of Defense could no longer deploy a service member into a theater of combat unless they were medically ready. So if you're in the active component like I was, you report to a base. Well, they have clinics there, they have dentists there, and they have a way to manage it. But in the Guard and Reserves, who now we started to deploy,
yes.
Before that we very seldom did, they had no way. They had no solution. I had a solution for them.
So you offered them a chance to make Guard and Reserve physically fit and
physically and
mentally and emotionally, or just physically, sir?
Back then it was just the physically, the vaccinations, the physical exams, the dental, all of this. Okay. So I said, we'll take teams and go right to the armories, to the bases. They train one weekend a month. We can show up. And they didn't have a solution. So they said, all right, we'll do a pilot program with you. And the first one was in Chillicothe, Ohio, at the armory. And I'll never forget, I took my old Jeep Wagoneer, took two nurses, and we headed to Chillicothe, Ohio. And Colonel Randy Randolph from the Department of Defense was there. And it was going like clockwork. And we were all we were doing was vaccinating back then. And I'll never forget, he was standing there, his arms folded, and he made this comment. He said, you can tell this is not being run by the government. And I said, excuse me, sir? He says, it's just going too smoothly.
I see.
And so that was the beginning. And so I got a $11 million contract, and so I hired my first 12 employees, and that contract grew to $156 million.
Over what period, sir?
That was in about over 5 years.
And was it just again focused on the
guard
and the reserves?
Yeah, we started out with just the Army Reserve, and it was so successful. We were in many cases taking the readiness level from 30, 32, 34% up to 90%. And so now they took all reserve components, all seven reserve components. So every time they added more, the value of the contract went up.
Yes.
And then the guards started coming on board.
Okay.
And then it went from vaccinations to doing the physicals. And then, well, can you do dental exams? Well, 43% of the service members needed restoration work. Oh, well, can you do the restoration work? So it just led from one thing to the next.
Which means you hired medical professionals, doctors and dentists.
Mm-hmm. And then all the staff that support it. So we have a whole fulfillment center. We built out what we called cold chain management. So in the past, the DOD would say, okay, well, they would ship the vaccine. So we're going to be at an armory in Topeka, Kansas, they ship 600 doses, different Hep A and flu or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the end of the weekend event, let's say there's 100 doses left over. Well, in the past, they would just leave it, and it would expire, and they would dispose of it. So there was millions of dollars of vaccines that would just be wasted. So what we do, we now manage it. We ship it. And then if there's you know, and we have to make sure it's credible. Certain vaccines need to be kept at certain temperatures. And then, so we finish up an event, and if there's vaccine left, we redistribute it.
I see.
So, you know, we know the expiration dates on it, so it saves the taxpayers millions of dollars. It's a lot more efficient. It's, you know, and so it just, the contract just, it just continued to grow. And of course, the more the contract grew, the more employees we hired,
sure,
the more family members. And so, like I said, it just, I mean, and the people here, it's not a job. It's a passion, you know, and I talk about that. You have to get up in the morning and be excited about what you do. It's not about the paycheck.
Is the focus still the reserves and the guards, or are you now dealing with our service people on active duty?
We're doing some of that, and we're looking into more and more of those opportunities. But it's gone from not only that, now the veterans.
Yes.
And that's, we just got a very, very large contract doing disability exams. So right now we're doing 25,000 to 30,000 disability exams a month. And that's just going to continue to grow. A veteran shouldn't have to travel for hours to go and to a clinic. He should be able to go in his own hometown, or, you know, he should be able to get in when he needs to get in. So we have built out, we're building out that whole platform.
Has your focus stayed? I think it was Mr. Abraham Lincoln who said, those that bore the burdens. Has your focus stayed with the veterans, or have you expanded that to other commercial companies?
It's all military, veterans and their families, because PTSD and all these issues are very challenging.
Do you have professionals that treat PTSD?
Oh, yes. And we do all the victims of the World Trade Center. So we manage their care. There were many, over thousands of volunteers who came from across the country who are now having issues, and we're managing that care. And we're doing some railroad exams for the railroad.
Does the returning vet of this era from Iraq and Afghanistan have basically the same issues that you did after your 393 days in country?
The difference is, I mean, being deployed into combat scars you for life. I said that earlier. We at least today welcome them back.
Okay. You were not welcomed.
Not at all. Okay. I mean, the day I landed in El Toro, California to come back, I hadn't seen my family for 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
I had to take my uniform off.
You did.
I took my uniform off. And the thing would be is you would almost disguise yourself from being a service member. You have to understand, back then, you know, we kind of let our hair grow longer, and, yes, you know, and hey, if you had your hair clipped like mine, you know, you
stood
were
out.
Automatically,
you'd
wear a hat, you know, and that was sad. I mean, I remember thinking, am I better off to go back? And I didn't want to, not at all.
What does the expression, thanks for your service, mean to you as a Vietnam vet?
Today it means a lot.
Does it?
It really does. And, you know, like I said, I, you know, there's only been two defining forces who've ever offered to die for us. I mean, when you think about it, one is Jesus Christ, and the other one are the men and women who serve. One died for our souls, and the other one for our freedoms.
Right. Country.
And look, we decide where we want to live. I know when we hire new employees, you know, if they want to move, come from another state or move to this community or to this state, that's a freedom. And if we have children, we can decide where we want them to go to school. If we worship, when and where. And we too often don't even think about it. And so when you say thank you, because it is, it's 1%. And today, I mean, recruiters, other than combat's the toughest mission in the military. The next is for recruiters to find that one individual, you know, and now, unless you're in the top 25%, In most cases, you're not even in your class. You're in many cases, you're not even considered. They wouldn't take me today. I'm not proud of this at all, but I was failing in high school. And I was told I probably wasn't going to graduate. And I said, I'm enlisting. And I believe that's why I got my diploma. They wouldn't consider me today.
I have a process question. I really don't know the answer. Was Logistics Health sold, and did you buy it back? Or are you now part of a larger company? Can you just talk about the process,
sir?
Sure.
As we continue to grow, these contracts come up normally every 5 years. There's a cycle. So when you're doing an $11 million contract, and even $100 million over 5 years, the competition out there is, the big, contractors that support the DoD and the VA. Mm-hmm. They don't look at, the smaller type opportunities.
The $11 million contract.
Right. Yeah. But once it got to be a half a billion, okay, all of a sudden, a company like Lockheed Martin says, hey, we're going after this business.
Oh, I see.
And I can't compete on my own because they buy it. They go in at such a low price that they have to get the award. And I couldn't compete. So once we got to that point, and they went out and bought a small company, so you have to have quals to qualify to bid on certain, these types of contracts.
Yep.
I knew we were in trouble. And so my biggest concern was all these jobs, these families. And I said, I need help. And a lot of companies go through acquisitions and they don't work out well. Mm-hmm. The reason being is culture.
Yep.
If the cultures don't, blend together, it's hard to succeed. So I had to find a company. Several large companies were very interested in acquiring us. Aetna was one. And I'm not saying that they're not good companies, but I mean, once I met with the leadership of those companies, I knew within hours this isn't going to work. So I went and started to meet with United Health. And they're Midwest. They're right here. They were very interested in really getting into this space. They really believe it's not all about the bottom line, but we need to be involved in taking care of the men and women who serve, their families. And I was very blessed that we were able to do it. They made an offer, and mm-hmm, we went through an acquisition. And sure enough, the next cycle, Lockheed came in so low, we would have lost the company.
Oh.
And because of the resources behind me, we were able to compete.
Okay.
And so to me, it's all about the families, and it's about the men and women we serve and the veterans. And, every day I tell our people, you can go home tonight with, a sense of peace of mind, and like I said earlier, having a fulfillment that I've made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's what we do, we touch lives every day and make a difference.
So then the status of the company is a subsidiary of
United Health.
Okay, but you're the CEO of...
Well, I have a CEO now who is going to be, I'm transitioning, the business over to her.
Because your company was sold when to United?
7 years ago.
7 years ago.
Right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, yes. And, you think about...
But you've been able to maintain the family culture and environment?
Exactly.
And this.
And they made a commitment to continue to grow and expand here in the community. When you look at our offices, and you go to what we would call high-rent districts, San Francisco, L.A., Dallas, Atlanta, and you look at what they pay for facilities per square foot, and then what they pay here. But more importantly, when they look at the caliber of the people and the quality of the work, and the wage scales, why would you not continue to invest into communities like this? And that's what they're doing. That's what we're doing. We just built out another whole block.
Is that the Bell Square?
Bell Square.
That's kind of a mixed use. That's got apartments and condos and retail and corporate offices.
Yes. So in April of 2015, that was surface parking. It had been surface parking owned by the county for over 20 years. Not one job, no tax base. Today, there's over 1,000 people working there. There's 93 families in the residential piece of it. It's taken downtown to another new level. Here in 2006, in September, we moved in this building. I had 151 employees. I didn't know how I was going to pay for this because it was you lease back the space. And I had an agreement with the city to build a building that could support up to 500 careers. And I could not put another company in here. It had to be our own growth. Like I said, I'm a risk taker. In August of 08, we hired employee 500. The tax base on this real estate down here, and you can look it up, was under $40,000. Today, it's over 1.2, and there's 2,000 families working on this campus. So, it's really changed the landscape of the whole downtown community.
Why do you feel so strongly that you want to help this city thrive, Mr. Weber?
Because it's the people, families. Think about it. I started a business on the West Coast in Los Angeles. 2 years later, I brought it back here. Nothing wrong with, it's a beautiful part of our country. A different culture. People want to come into work at 9 and leave at 3. Fridays, here I have in my office, our motto, and it came from the Marine Corps, 1st Battalion, 4th Marines, whatever it takes. And that's our attitude here. And that's the people. It's the quality of the families, the people. We have some of the best health care in the country, in the world, right here. Mayo, Gunderson, both of them are continuing to invest in the whole region and the state. And the education, we always rank in the top three in the country for schools. So when we're interviewing families, I get asked, first question is the younger families is, what are your private schools like? They ask me, because where they're coming from, the best you get are private schools.
I see.
And I tell them, we have great private schools, but go out and talk to the principals of our schools, the superintendents, and they come back and they're amazed at our schools. And then they'll ask me about health care. Well, there's no question about that. We have two of the best. And so our young people want more of a balanced life. They want a wholesome life. They want, it's about family. So we invest in our families, our employees, their families, and it's the best return on the bottom line. The average number of sick days amongst over 2,000 employees last year?
1.92.
Less than 2 sick days per employee per year. They want to be here.
You sound like you're a champion of the millennial generation that is often criticized.
No, they...
You love them.
They're wonderful. They've figured a lot of things out. They really have. And, getting a paycheck every 2 weeks is important. It's important to them. They have tuition and they have families and homes. But more importantly, it's about a balanced life, a quality life. It's their family. And that's so important. I've worked all my life. When my children were young, I wasn't around. You can't get that back.
Right.
And every day that goes by is one day less. And our young people want things that are convenient and accessible. There are employees who will ask when we offer merit raises and say, well, can I get rather than a merit raise, can I get an extra day of PTO? What does that tell you?
Yeah.
And
you've had many successes in business. You are a risk taker. What haven't you achieved? What's your next set of goals over your remaining years of your career?
Well, first and foremost, my family. In the end, I believe a couple of things. Number one, I believe what goals you achieve are not as important as what you become. And in the end, the only thing you take with you is what you've given away. Mm-hmm. And when Dad died, Mom had $7,000, a small little house. But they lived a rich, full life. And I've told my family, I've told my wife that you've been through a lot. I'm going to make sure you're always taken care of. But if there's $7,000 left and I've done the right thing, that's my life. I do not want it to destroy my family. I see what happens at times when people start to acquire material wealth. Now, it's a good thing, it can be, to succeed if you do the right thing with it. But I also see how it damages and ruins families. I know families are very dysfunctional because they don't understand that there's a huge need and we can do something to help. There's a big burden. It's a heavy burden. And no one person can carry the weight by themselves. And so every time that we have every Monday new employee orientation, I see these young people. Or we have these nurses who, when they come out of nursing school, they want to work at a hospital organization where they're touching the patients. But after they've done it for 20 years, they go, I want something that's more structured. I want an 8 to 5. I want my holidays off. Yeah. And they're very talented, experienced people. And I always say, you know, experiences as you go through life grow into wisdom. And so, you know, outside of LHI, we've got 400 employees now working in other areas.
The waterfront restaurant and your hotel.
The hotels, the Bell Square, our yes. fulfillment center up right. there. You know, I mean, so... And I'm doing the same thing with them.
Have you thought about the promise of people like Bill Gates to eventually give away a large part of what they've been fortunate enough to get? Have you thought about taking that pledge?
Oh, it's happened.
It's happened.
Oh yes.
Okay.
Yeah, there's not going to be my bank account and my investments. Are going to be very limited when I'm gone. And my children understand that. You know, they were offered an opportunity to go on a school, college, technical school, whatever they chose. And if they focused on their grades, they didn't have to worry about how they're going to pay their tuition.
Excuse me.
Okay. Well, beyond that, they have to earn it.
Okay.
They have to earn it, and they have to work hard, and they have to understand about giving back. Giving is not what's... When you give something, it's not what's... True giving isn't what's extra and left over. True giving is when you sacrifice, and you do something that makes a difference to you personally. I mean, 90-plus percent of our employees are all here giving back. Nobody even comes close when it comes to the United Way. $300,000, you know, a company our size in a community like this.
Right.
But people, the greatest gift I tell them that you can give anyone is when you volunteer. Because the most precious thing we all have is our own personal time.
Yeah.
As I said, every day that goes by is one day less. And I believe we all have a set amount of time. And so when you volunteer and you're giving someone part of yourself, there's no greater gift. And we can't change the past, and we can't control the future. So I tell them, live the moment.
Are you at the point where you've thought about a legacy, Mr. Weber, and what you would like it to be?
I just hope that these businesses continue to thrive. And all these young people, this young talent, you know, continues to grow and raise families. When I stop at a coffee shop in the morning and get myself a cup of coffee when I go to the office, and a young lady comes up and she says, my husband and I, we're celebrating today, and I'm thinking anniversary. I said, well, what's the occasion? We're buying our first home. That, to me. That, and then knowing the men and women who serve are taken better care of. That is very important. And the homeless people. We right here, you know, I can take you four blocks up. There's 2 to 4 every evening, homeless, mm-hmm. under this canopy, blankets and pillows. So I have 2 grandsons, 9 and 14. So, you know, they're on their iPads, and I drive by, and I said to my one grandson who was 9, I said, Gus, see those homeless people? And I drove by, and he looked, and he said, yeah, Grandpa, and then he's right. I go around down the block, and I said, you think they're hungry? Yeah, probably. See, there's no connection. Mm-hmm. So I go down and pull into Jimmy John's sub shop. I said, I'll be right back. I go and I get a whole box of subs. And I'm going back, and I said, hey, Gus, you know those homeless people, you think they're hungry. I said, we're going to drop these subs off, and you're going to give them these subs. And he stopped. Well, Grandpa, I mean, you're going with me. I said, no, I can't. I have to stay in the vehicle. So you have to walk out, get out, and go over on the curb and the sidewalk there. No. So I get there, and I go ahead. And they come out from their blankets, and he's handing them subs, and they're thanking him. And he gets in, and one comes running up, knocks on the window, and says, thank you, thank you. Well, you know what? That made an impression on him.
Yeah.
And I do that often. And I look at those poor individuals, you know. And we have, my Christmas was a week ago last Thursday. It's our dinner giving. We do it every year, and we pick up the homeless veterans. You know, we have 20 in the county. And, you know, and those living on the edge. And we have Christmas for them. And they come down here, and they don't know what to expect. And we take them into our banquet room, and we have tablecloths and dishes and plates. And they come in, and they just don't quite know what's going to go on. And then I have our veterans who work here sit with them. And they have a big steak. They have turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy, cranberries. That's their Thanksgiving dinner. And then we box up things for them. And we have mittens and hats and gloves. And then I have a $75 gift card for Walmart. Mm-hmm. And there's no tobacco or alcohol, but you can get essentials. When a veteran comes up to you and says, you know, I have 4 grandchildren I've never seen, and I'm going to buy them. It's the first time I'm going to buy them a Christmas gift. You know, what do you get at Walmart for 4 grandchildren? It didn't matter. You know, it could have been a toothbrush, but he was able to get them something.
That's very important.
So, well, so now, in some of them have been through hell, mm-hmm. and they need help transitioning back.
Well, I do want to respect your time. Let me ask you broadly, what advice do you give a millennial now sorting through her or his career, your advice?
Don't fear failure, first and foremost. There's nothing wrong with it. I think it's one of the corner posts on the foundation that you build of success. You know, I've been there many times. I'll probably fail again in the future. I don't think about it. I think about the impact it could have on other people, but not myself. And so not to fear failure, to be willing to take risk.
Is it courageous to not fear failure? Because I know courage is a big part.
Very much.
Okay.
Oh, yes. To be able to face fear head on and then dig down deep for that courage and to have faith. I always say, if you really, truly believe in something, you have to have the will to try and the faith to believe it's possible. And you have to draw on that faith, even when you're down and out. It's amazing what it'll do for you.
Don Weber, thank you so much for talking to Wisconsin.
Oh, thank you. Yes, sir.
Congratulations on a very successful career.
And well, it's not me. I've been very blessed. You know, I always say, I believe God determines who walks into our life. We decide who we let go and who we keep. I've had a lot of wonderful people walk into my life, and that's why I am as successful as I've been, truly.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you guys heading back?